This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. The U.S. Senate has been called the world's greatest deliberative body. Few people would describe it that way these days. Sadly, many Americans know it as a hyperpartisan chamber of gridlock and dysfunction. The atmosphere was so toxic that longtime moderate GOP Senator Olympia Snowe of Maine called it quits last year. That opened an opportunity for the former two-term Maine Governor Angus King, who won the seat last November. King is an independent, a man who answers to no party, though he caucuses with the Democrats in Washington. He was optimistic on the eve of his election about the possibility of a grand bargain on the country's budget, the prospect of filibuster reform, and on a chance to blow away some of the politically toxic fog that has settled over the Potomac. So a few months later, how does all that look? Well, joining me now from Washington is Maine's independent Senator Angus King. And Senator, welcome to Radio Boston. Great pleasure to have you.
Hey, great to be with you. I think the first time I was on this station was a few weeks after I was elected governor in 1994. Man, that goes back a ways.
That does. Well, we're happy to have you back. And let me just put out this question to listeners. Listeners, we've got Angus King, independent senator from Maine, with us for the next 15 or 20 minutes or so. What's your question? Do you see Washington as too partisan, not partisan enough? Do we need a grand bargain? Can we do without one? Do we need more independents like Angus King? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And Senator King, as we mentioned, your predecessor, Olympia Snowe, decided not to run for a fourth term last November because she came to believe that the partisanship in Washington had just become too much, too polarizing, too paralyzing. You ran as an independent, as a sort of none-of-the-above candidate. So after, a few weeks on the job now, what's your view of the climate in Washington? Give us the quick report.
Well, the quick report is there's good news and bad news. The good news is that there are some tender shoots of bipartisanship. Probably the most prominent one is the work that's going on between Republican and Democratic senior senators on the subject of immigration.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years ago, immigration, nobody wanted to touch, particularly the Republicans were very fierce on that issue. And now all of a sudden there's some very important discussions going on that could well lead to a breakthrough piece of legislation. Now, there's a lot of ground to cover between now and then. And, of course, you've got the question of what the position of the House is going to be. But that's a promising sign. Here's the interesting thing that I've observed. I've been here now a couple of months. Personally, the atmosphere is not as poisonous as people have been led to believe. And what I mean by that is, it's not like people growl at each other when they pass in the hall. There is a great deal of talk back and forth and discussion of the issues. And probably the best piece of advice I can give to people to sort of get a little flavor of this is to watch C-SPAN 2 when there's a vote on the Senate floor, because that's the time when all the senators are there. It's like Market Square on Saturday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's talking with each other, little knots of people, and some of it is light and personal and some of it is very substantive. But there are those discussions going on. Now, where the bad news is, it still is this partisan, locking arms. The example last week that was very disappointing to me was a Republican filibuster of President Obama's nominee for the District Court of Appeals, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. And, frankly, I believe that the arguments against this judge were pretty weak and thin. And yet, they knocked off the nominee because they couldn't muster 60 votes.
Let me ask, that
was disappointing.
Sure. Well, let me ask you. I love this term you turned there. That you're seeing tender shoots of bipartisanship springing up. But to the extent that there isn't bipartisanship and this sense of partisanship, is it? I mean, what's your view? Is it based on the merits and deep belief, or is there? Have folks sort of crossed over down there, and is it personal? That is, people are sort of denying each other the victory or the possibility of compromise because it's not really about the issues. It's just about, winning and losing, exactly.
Well, I got to tell you, that's one of the most disappointing things. And it's for example, there's all this talk about how are we going to solve or can we do a grand bargain on the budget? And yet there's a lot of talk on the Republican side. We can't let Obama win again.
Mm.
Obama won in January on the fiscal cliffs. He's not going to win again. And I got to tell you that, you know, there are media outlets down here that sort of specialize in covering Washington and Capitol Hill, and they're into this too. I mean, it's all played as if it was a sporting match and who won and who lost. You know, Harry Reid caved on the filibuster, or, you know, did Obama win the fiscal cliff? And that does impede the ability to get anything done. And it sounds silly, but, you know, these are ordinary human beings, and they are subject to those kinds of things. And that's why I think, frankly, the president's outreach to the Congress in the last couple of weeks, people are making fun of it. But I think it's important. It's probably something he should have done, you know, 4 years ago and made a regular part. But now he's doing it, and I think it's a good idea. But you asked the question: is it ideological or is it personal? It's a little bit personal, but this, particularly on the finance stuff, if you think about it, really comes down to the core values of the two parties.
Mm-hmm.
On the Democratic side, protecting the New Deal, protecting Social Security and Medicare are core values, and the Republicans want modifications to both of those programs. So that's the Democratic view. On the Republican side, their core value is you know, no new taxes and no new revenues, and the government is big enough. And so it's really hard to get compromise where you're talking about core values. And then as I was thinking about it over the weekend, it goes even deeper than that. It goes to the, I don't know, if core values, and that is, what's the role of government?
Hmm.
And the Republicans' view is government should be much smaller. There was a conservative witness at a budget hearing I was at last week, and I said, how big should government be? What percentage of the economy should the federal government be? And he sort of hemmed and hawed and didn't want to answer, but finally he blurted out 12%. Well, it hasn't. The federal revenues and expenditures haven't been 12% since about 1910. I mean, that's a radical restructuring of what we expect of government. On the other hand, of course, the Democrats feel and believe that government has an important role to play in terms of our society and equity and protecting those who are most vulnerable. So that's one of the reasons that this is so hard. It is personal, it is political, but it also comes down to how the parties define themselves.
Yeah. I'm wondering, you know, I want to talk to you a little bit about sequestration and sort of where the country goes from here, and specifically what can happen in the Senate. But I'm curious about this. I was reading about the way you operated when you were governor of Maine, and I came across sort of one of your local journalists up in Maine wrote about Angus King being good at sort of grabbing the Democratic and Republican Party leaders, and sort of the image he created was sort of dragging them into your office and closing the door and basically just getting it done and just sort of staying out of sight until the deal was done. And, you know, and I'm wondering if there isn't a sort of Camp David approach to this that President Obama couldn't work on.
I've been suggesting that for about a month. Actually, the president called me. I was one of the recipients of one of his calls about 2 weeks ago, and I said, why don't you take these guys to Camp David? That's exactly what I said. Take them up there, lock the door, and you know, nobody leaves until it's done. Then I said, you know, maybe it would be even better to take them to that ship down in Mobile with the bad plumbing, the cruise ship. And, you know,
provide some incentive to get the deal done, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that would resolve it even faster. But his response was interesting. His response was, look, these guys won't go. They won't. You know, John Boehner apparently has been instructed by his caucus, no negotiations with the president.
Mm.
And so, you know, what I found is that there are layers of blame around here, and there's always plenty to go around. But, yeah, I mean, I used to have breakfast. I had breakfast every Tuesday morning with the Republican and Democratic leadership at the governor's residence up in Maine for 8 years. Whenever the legislature was in session. And one of the things I've learned in situations like this is you have to build relationships before the crisis hits. You know, you have to have some relationship, some knowledge of the other people, how they work, how they think, what they need, what they do. You can't summon it forth in the midst of a 1 hour meeting at the White House with that you just don't have. So
in that regard, President Obama might have been able to be perhaps a little more aggressively have reached out a little more aggressively prior to the real crisis hitting.
Yeah, that's what I think. Now, you know, there are people down here that poo-poo that, but there are wonderful stories down here about, you know, the LBJ and Everett Dirksen and Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan, and I think there's something to that, and I think it would help, and I think, you know, I think the president is figuring that out. I mean, we've all seen Lincoln, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Seen Lincoln. The whole theme of Lincoln is that the president can't sit at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue and hope things go well in the Congress.
Yeah.
I mean, Lincoln got his hands dirty. I mean, he was involved in getting the final dozen votes for the 13th Amendment. And the whole point of the movie is if he hadn't done it, it probably wouldn't have happened. And who knows when it would have happened.
Listeners, we're talking to Angus. Excuse me, Senator. Listeners, we're talking to Angus King, independent senator from Maine. What's your question for Angus King about the way Washington works, about the role of an independent senator and an independent politician in by any definition is a pretty polarized, politically polarized climate? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And if it's okay, Senator, let's take a couple of calls. We've got some people already lined up. Andy
Absolutely.
Is calling from Southboro. Hi, Andy. You're on the air with Senator King.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if there was any hope for independents and moderates in these a coalesce and come together, form third party.
Andy, your cell phone is sort of dropping out, but I did get the sketch of your question from my producer, so I'm just going to put the question to Senator King. Is there any hope for coalescing independents into a moderate third party, Senator King?
Well, you know, it's hard. If you look back on the history of this country, third parties have come forth either in response to an overriding crisis issue like slavery, which is what the foundation of the Republican Party was in the 1850s, or some kind of very charismatic leader. It's hard to get people fired up to join what amounts to a moderate party. I mean, it just doesn't. You know, the activists want to be activists on the right or on the left. A raging moderate is a pretty unusual creature. But on the other hand, I believe this is where most of the people in the country are. I mean, you made a joke at the beginning of the campaign. During the campaign, a guy said, "All my life, I've wanted to vote for none of the above,
mm-hmm.
and you're it. So there is a real thirst out there for people to have some outlet for their votes other than the two parties who are constantly fighting with each other. I mean, people are just fed up with it, and hopefully the senators are hearing that when they go home.
So do you have a particular role, Angus King, that you can play there? I mean, as an independent, I know you caucus with the Democrats, but do you have a certain sort of portfolio that allows you to move between the Democratic leadership and the Republican leadership, and almost as like a sort of Henry Kissinger type, sort of doing shuttle diplomacy to try to make things happen?
Well, it's funny you should say that because that's a character. I was at home over the weekend, and I said I feel like Henry Kissinger doing shuttle diplomacy. When I came down here as an independent, I had no idea how I was going to be received. I had some little trepidation that maybe everybody was just going to freeze me out and say, we're not going to talk to this guy because we don't want this to happen again. But to the contrary, I've gotten a very warm reception from both sides. I had to decide who to caucus with because that's how you get on your committees. And, mm-hmm. you know, I could have staked out and said, I'm going to sit in the middle of the aisle and not caucus with anybody. But that would have been not fair to Maine because it would have compromise my effectiveness as a senator, but Harry Reid understands that I am an independent. Now, I'm looking for opportunities to try to bring people together. I think there may end up being a grand bargain on the budget, but both sides are going to have to move a bit. The Democrats are going to have to move on entitlements, and the Republicans are going to have to move on revenues. But I think there's at least some chance of that, not in the next couple of weeks, but over the course of when we try to move toward a budget in the next month or so.
It's strange, though, to say that there's just a chance of it when you think about how this whole deal came together. I mean, it was designed to be so absurd and awful that it would never come to be. And yet here we are, you know, faced with what, $85 billion of cuts coming down the road.
In the most indiscriminate and dumb way.
And so how does that affect a state like yours? I mean, how, you know, because sometimes you'll hear folks in Washington say that, well, in fact, these cuts aren't going to be that bad. Give us a sort of quick snapshot.
Here's my analysis of it. The Democrats were, and I think the president was, gambling that it was going to be so bad that people were going to rise up and say we can't accept this and push pressure on the Republicans to come to a resolution. I think the Republicans had the opposite assumption, that it wasn't going to be so bad and people were going to greet it with a yawn and, you know, we'd get the cuts and move on. The truth is, I think, as I analyze it, is somewhere in between. The cuts are going to have severe impacts, but on limited populations in limited areas. Mm. For example, the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard down in southern Maine, there are 4,700 people there who, starting in a few weeks, are going to have to take off an unpaid day a week. Mm. That's a 20% pay cut. That's significant, and it's going to have a significant impact on the economy of that region of Maine. But does it affect, you know, a grocery store clerk in Portland? Probably not, or at least not directly. Do you see what I mean?
It's
going to have a serious effect, but it's going to be localized, so that I don't think it's going to generate the kind of backlash that I think the president and the Democrats were expecting. Now, you know, when it starts to actually, you know, bite in around the 1st of April, I may be proven wrong, and it may generate a backlash. But the problem is the cut. You know, you're going to lose a teacher here and a Head Start teacher in this town and that town, all of which are very serious cumulatively.
Sure. I mean, these are real issues.
Whether or not they will – they're real issues and they're serious, but whether or not they will generate the kind of general public pressure to try to get, you know, push people toward a solution, I'm just not sure. Fortunately, we're working on it anyway. I mean, we're hoping to get a budget out of the Senate for the first time in 3 or 4 years in the next month, and it will contain significant deficit reduction. So whether or not how that's going to interface with the sequester is not clear at this point.
Angus King, stand by. We're going to tick through a couple more calls. George is calling from Arlington. Hi, George. You're on the air with Angus King.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Senator King, my question is this. When you mentioned a minute ago that Speaker Boehner had received the word had come down to him from his caucus, don't negotiate with the president, my first thought was, well, how much of that can we tolerate in the House and Senate before it really begins to threaten the machinery of these bodies, and what is to be done about it?
That's a big question. Angus King.
That's a great question, and it just goes to the heart of this of the lack of functionality down here, and you know, the very beginning of getting anything done is talking to one another, but it gets back to what I don't know if you heard at the very beginning of the program, a lot of this stuff is about winning and losing, and you know the Republicans don't want to negotiate with Obama, I guess, because they're afraid they might be perceived to lose, but you know who really loses is the country. I mean, I have to tell you, I think the solution to the deficit problem, everybody down here knows. It's some level of entitlement reform, because the long-term deficit problem is health care. The underlying functions of government aren't growing that fast. In fact, they're actually shrinking. Defense isn't growing very fast. It's really all about the cost of health care. Over the next 20 years, health care is projected to go, just the health care expenditures of the federal government, which is Medicare, Medicaid, federal employees, is going to go from 4% of GDP to 12%. That's huge.
Hmm.
Everybody knows that we've got to do something about that. They also know, I think even the Republicans in their heart of hearts, know that there have to be some additional revenues.
I guess they say they've already given their additional revenues.
They've already given, I've done the math, and I don't think it works, particularly at a time when we've got an aging population. You know, we've got 10. Here's an amazing figure: 10,000 people a day are becoming eligible for Medicare. 10,000 people a day, as the baby boomers move in to Medicare and Social Security, it's going to increase the burden on those programs. You just can't avoid it. And to say we can get by with less revenues when that's happening because of demographics and the accelerating cost of health care just isn't realistic. So I think most of these folks know in their heart that they've got to give on these things, but nobody wants to be the first to do it. Nobody wants to say we're going to take the initiative, and everybody's saying, oh, no, we've got to win the next battle.
Let's go to
frustrating.
Let's go to Andrew, who's calling from Danvers. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you. A couple of weeks ago, maybe 3-4 weeks ago, you had a senator or a congressman who had, you know, served a term or two like 30 or 40 years ago and then came back and just got reelected.
Andrew, I think we're losing your call as well. But again, I've got it on the screen, so I'm going to read Angus King, what my producer put up here. Are senators spending enough time in Washington like they used to? Do they even know each other? And how does that affect their work?
That's a very perceptive question, and I think it's a problem. I actually worked here in the 70s. I was a junior staffer in the U.S. Senate in the 70s. And at that time, senators and congressmen, by and large, lived in Washington. Mm-hmm. Their families were here. Their kids were here. Their kids went to the local schools. And, you know, they were in Washington, Maryland, Virginia. But they were in this area. Now, everybody goes home Thursday night and comes back Sunday night or Monday morning. And you don't have those relationships. You don't have the kind of, you know, personal relationships that sprung up when people were all together. You only come in and you're only here, you know, sort of in the arena, and you're never you don't have the adult beverage at the end of the week or the barbecue with the family and those kinds of things. I think that's a very perceptive question, and I've talked to a lot of folks around Washington, and they think it's a part of the problem. One of the most profound observations a friend ever made to me was, you can't hate someone if you know the names of their kids.
You know, it sounds...
And we've lost a lot of that.
Yeah. Angus King, a lot of what you're describing, the sort of lack of knowing each other there, the paralysis, the hyper-partisanship, I mean, this is all stuff you knew when you were running for the Senate. I'm just wondering, is even now that you're there, or now that you're back, because as you said, you were a staffer back in the 70s, is it even worse than you thought?
Well, it sort of goes back to what I said at the beginning. It's not worse in the sense of the person, the people. I think I like the people. They're ordinary citizens. The old stereotypical pompous senator, you know, that talks like this and blah, 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 they're not here. And yet there's something about the system that keeps us from working together and getting things done. It's pretty bad. There's no question. We've got to figure it out, because the country has a whole. This is what I used to say in the campaign. We've got a whole series of important issues to deal with, but we can't get to the issues of whether it's health care, energy, climate change, debt and deficit, all of those things, if we can't make the institution itself work. That's the reason I ran. I mean, people said, why are you running? You know, you're a governor and you're retired and teaching and having a pretty decent life in Maine. Why would somebody want to leave Maine to move to Washington, which is a very good question. But my answer was I'm running for the opposite reason that Olympia Snow left. I'm running because I want to try to help. And perhaps my experience as an independent, my role as an independent, I can play a role here and try to be a sort of moderate voice. And there are other moderates here on both sides. I'm a perennial optimist, and I think we have a duty to try to help our country.
Well, we need perennial optimists down there. We're glad you're there. Angus King, thanks so much for joining us. We're very, very grateful. Sorry we're out of time, but it's been terrific having you. Thank you very much.
Well, great to be with you, and I'll update you from time to time.
Please do.
With progress.
We'd love to have you back anytime. Angus King is an independent senator from Maine. Listeners, you can keep the conversation going at RadioBoston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, an operatic interpretation of Sister Helen Prejean's Dead Man Walking. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.